Well, I want to welcome you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly. I'm the chair of the Psychology Forum, and I've actually heard Dr. Murthy speak on psychopath and psychopathy many times. I never tired of hearing it. Dr. Murthy is a licensed clinical psychologist and neuropsychologist with over 11 years' experience conducting primarily psychological assessment with forensic criminal populations. He's served as the chairperson of medical education for California Medical Facility in Vacaville, a state prison, chairperson of the Department of Psychology, and chairperson of continuing ed for psychologists. Additionally, he has supervised psychology graduate students in their clinical internships and was coordinator of psychological assessment services for the San Quentin State Prison, which is a really big deal. He's an authority on the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, which is the premier psychological test to determine if somebody's psychopathic, and has conducted numerous court-ordered psychological evaluations related to violent risk prediction and criminal recidivism. Dr. Murthy has a private practice in which he performs psychological evaluations that assess for symptoms of mental illness and neuropsychological impairment. I see at my insistence he put up some of his cards out here. So please welcome Dr. Murthy.
Thank you. Thanks, Pat. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here and speak with you today about psychopathy. I'll tell you that my interest in psychopathy started in graduate school. My first clinical placement was at San Francisco County Jail, and I began to work with criminal populations. And during that time, I began to read about criminal populations and some of the literature around the specific issues that are relevant, and I encountered psychopathy. I found it captivating, and perhaps that's partly the reason why you've been brought here today. What captivated me is seeking an understanding intellectually of what might be this thing that seems the closest resemblance to evil that we may encounter in our clinical work, or those of us in the profession may encounter. So I became very interested and did a lot of reading and, you know, made sure that I learned and was trained in the assessment and identification of psychopaths. Now I'll tell you that my interest in psychopathy is actually very small, because after having worked with them for a while, I prefer to spend my time with people who are able to have compassion and caring for other people, which psychopaths cannot. So it's something that I still work with because, as Patrick mentioned, I'm still employed at San Quentin Prison. But now I prefer to spend my time with those who are compassionate and with the mentally ill, not exclusive groups. But today we'll talk about psychopathy. So this man should look somewhat familiar. Yeah, that's Ted Bundy. And the reason why I've brought him to you and to start the presentation is that in many ways he's the classic psychopath. He was a very intelligent man who was known for being very charming with the media during his trial and throughout his incarceration, and also for being particularly good at conning the vulnerable. One of his modus operandi was that he would, as most of you probably know, he was a serial killer and serial rapist. But one of his modus operandi was he would present with his arm in a sling, present to women, young women, who were his victims. And he would present with a story that his arm was broken or he was severely injured and he was loading something into his truck and could they please help him just to move this thing. And so they would go with him and in many cases they would try to assist him. And then at that point he would have isolated them and put them in a position where he could quickly attack and overpower them. So he's the classic psychopath because he's very superficially charming, he's manipulative, and his crimes were horrendous, and he was extremely callous in his behavior. What many people don't know is that he actually had an extensive criminal history beyond just the rapes and murders, which began at a very young age, which is also characteristic of psychopaths, as well as having two escape attempts, one of which was successful. I want to read you a quote by Ted Bundy, and it should strike a chord with you. "You are going to kill me." This is a quote from him the day before his execution, after he had actually already confessed to the murders. And at this point, he was actually trying to persuade the courts to stay his execution so that by telling them that he would be able to provide additional information on the location of bodies that hadn't been found yet. And the court eventually did not go along with that. But he was executed. But this is one of his last quotes before he was killed. He says, "You are going to kill me, and that will protect society. But out there are many, many people who are addicted to pornography, and you are doing nothing about that." Now, that should really strike a chord with you, because you have a breadth of emotional feeling, and Ted Bundy, a psychopath, does not. So for him to equate viewing pornography with committing serial murders and serial rapes doesn't strike a chord, because to him, they're essentially, one is not particularly more horrendous than the other. But for most of us, the vast majority of us, there's a huge difference, and we can resonate emotionally with that, and we're disturbed by reading this quote. But it's characteristic of psychopaths that they're not. So this man should also probably be familiar to most of you. This is Charles Manson. Also another charismatic psychopath, known for being, in particular, a cult leader who engineered a series of mass murders. There are a couple reasons why I brought him up. Primarily, again, what many people don't know about Mr. Manson is that he had a lengthy history of a variety of criminal behavior, which began at a very young age, very characteristic of criminal psychopaths. His crimes included burglary, armed robbery, auto theft, pimping, forgery, attempted murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. So it was very extensive. One particular piece of information about Charles Manson and his crimes, in particular the Tate and LaBianca murders, is that the murders were committed in very cold blood with a very much intended consequence. They were instrumental. The murders were designed to set off a race riot. Manson believed that if these murders were committed and it were believed by the public that they were committed by racial minorities, that this would touch off a race riot. And during the emerging chaos, Manson and his followers would ascend to power. That was the belief. But what it illustrates is the cold-bloodedness of the crimes and the instrumental nature of the crimes as well. They were committed, without any feeling, to achieve a very specific purpose. Instrumental violence is characteristic of psychopathic violence. I don't know if this man is a psychopath or not. The reason why I've shown him to you is because in my work, what I do most of the time, I'm evaluating prison inmates, people who have criminal histories, and I'm trying to determine whether or not they are psychopaths. And most of the time, I'm not seeing serial killers. Most of the time, I'm seeing heavily identified prison inmates who identify very, very severely with a criminal lifestyle. What I've shown you is a gang member from the Mara Salvatrucha, a particularly cold-hearted gang. I don't know if this man is a psychopath or not, but this is more the type of person that I encounter in my work, and this is the question that arises for me. Is this or is this not a psychopath? So I'll provide you with a definition. This is my definition. A psychopath is a highly dangerous personality with a lifelong history of a variety of harmful crimes with no conscience or sense of empathy for the victims and who does not appear to benefit from treatment. Those are the most salient points of a psychopath. This is relevant to us because a psychopath's behavior is predictable, predictably poor. They're very likely to commit crimes, in particular violent crimes. A psychopath's response to treatment is also predictable, predictably poor. They do not appear to show a benefit from treatment. And as mental health professionals, we're responsible for managing our resources and the safety of ourselves and the community and our patients. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the history. Philippe Pinel was a French psychiatrist who worked in an asylum, and he was presented with a very specific, interesting problem. He encountered a large population of very violent individuals who behaved in an extremely outrageous and unpredictable and violent manner that didn't appear to be crazy. So he tried to describe his findings, and there's a quote. He came up with this idea called manie sans délire, which means mania without delirium. I want to read a quote to you that he said in describing this phenomenon he encountered. He said, "I thought that madness was inseparable from delirium or delusion, and I was surprised to find many maniacs who at no period gave evidence of any lesion of understanding, yet seemed to have a defect in affect or volition." So affect or volition, to those who aren't involved in the mental health field, affect means emotion, and volition can be understood as meaning intention. What he was bringing up was that perhaps these people don't quite seem crazy in the sense, although their behavior certainly looks like it. And he touched off a debate that went on for about 140 years, and that debate was, are these people that are capable of such severe and atrocious behavior, are they considered mad or are they simply bad? So 140 years abridged. During this time, scholars and analysts explore psychopathy. One of the first ideas that comes up is this idea of moral insanity, that these people are so severely immoral in their behavior that we designate them as morally insane. That was one of the earlier sort of discussions around explaining where this behavior comes from. Over time, psychopathy began to get conceptualized as an aggressive form of narcissism. So with narcissism, what we have is a very fragile ego, a very fragile sense of self. And because that sense of self is very fragile, what's needed is some form of identification to shore it up, to make it stronger. So narcissists develop an image of themselves that's inaccurate, a grossly inflated image of themselves as great and powerful in some way. Part of the nature of the narcissist, in addition to having this grandiose ego that requires admiration and constant shoring up in order to feel okay about themselves, is an oblivious to the emotional needs and general existence of other people. So what was noted is that psychopaths display this narcissism, but unlike many narcissists, they are particularly aggressive and violent. And that is, even today, the basic conceptualization around psychopathy as an aggressive and violent, usually violent form of narcissism. Analysts speculated about the inner dynamics of psychopaths, what's going on inside of them from an analytic perspective. The theory generally ran the line of that there is a sense of inner emptiness inside of psychopaths, a sort of a strong negativity, sometimes referred to as a zero state, and that negativity is, psychopaths will seek to avoid it at all costs. And the only way that they can maintain an avoidance of this inner negativity is through destruction of other people, that they experience something called contemptuous delight by destroying, whether it be through fantasy in the form of deception, whether it be physically in the form of aggression. Destroying another person is a way that the psychopath can momentarily feel excited and forget about that feeling of inner emptiness. This is the theory. Controversial. Many people don't think it applies. That's what the analysts think. Deception and denial. So the literature, and we still believe this today as well, that psychopaths are by their nature extremely deceptive. They cannot help but tell lies. It's part of their nature. And it's a web of lies when you're interviewing or talking to one. In addition, there is actually the act of denial, which is also something that's quite prevalent for psychopaths. And that denial is denying who they really are, denying what they've done, denying whom they've harmed, and denying many of their baser feelings, feelings like jealousy. Origins were discussed in the literature as well. That went through a time period. Initially, people thought, well, it must be biological in nature. People looked for physical signs. Then the idea shifted more to it being more of a sense of nurture, that it was the way they were brought up, the holding environment, something about the mother. And then things have shifted more recently to a more integrative approach. So that's a bit of an abridgment of 140 years. Kleckley wrote the first great book, and it's a beautiful read. You know, I'm sure you're all here because you find the topic interesting. I highly recommend reading it. It published in 1941. It's called The Mask of Sanity. And what Kleckley did was he characterized psychopathy as a personality disorder. And what that means is that it's not a state. It's not a question of one feels depressed and then the depression resolves and one feels better. One may hear voices and then takes medications and the voices go away. A personality disorder is who a person is. It develops early, and it generally stays throughout life. And that's how psychopathy is conceptualized by Kleckley and by everyone today. Cleckley also came up with some specific criteria on how to designate a psychopath, which was very important, because at this point it was a little bit more speculative. And here's what he came up with. I'm going to go through the criteria to try to help you have an understanding of what a psychopath is. So the first thing he came up with is superficial charm and good intelligence. And I'll talk about the intelligence piece first. We know today that psychopathy doesn't have anything to do with intelligence. Psychopaths can be highly intelligent, and they can be mentally retarded. It's an independent feature from intellectual ability. So Cleckley was kind of wrong about that. But what he was right about was the fact that a lot of this behavior, this outrageous, uncontrolled, violent, and aggressive behavior, was not due to any intellectual defect. That he was right about. The superficial charm, he was describing a personality that can be very charming and engaging. And many psychopaths are like this. When you talk to them, you may find a little bit of excitement. They may draw you in. You may find a little flair to their personality. You may be quite captivated, and they do captivate a lot of people. But it's a superficial thing. There's no deeper relationship or relatedness to it, although some people will see that. Next criterion, absence of delusions or irrational thinking. Now, this also is dated, and today we know that psychopaths can be delusional, and they can experience major mental illness that can cause their thinking to become irrational, but that's not a characteristic of psychopathy. While the behavior may be outrageous, violent, and aggressive, it's not because of any delusional beliefs or any inability to think rationally that they behave the way they do. That's what Cleckley's saying. Absence of nervousness or psychoneuroses. Cleckley noted that psychopaths don't appear to have a lot of anxiety, and they're not vulnerable to things like depression. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. Unreliability. These are not reliable people, psychopaths. They can't be counted on for anything except for the likelihood that they'll engage in violent behavior. And then untruthfulness and insincerity. And as I said, for psychopaths, lying is really a pattern of behavior that's in their core. It's very natural to them to lie, and it's very natural to them to tell even more outrageous lies in order to get out of the lies when they're sometimes questioned or caught. And insincerity, meaning they may express a lot of things that may appear to have some emotional depth to them, but the truth is that they don't sincerely feel much of anything. So they'll be both insincere in what they say to you, and you can expect that there'll be a lot of lies and untruthfulness. Lack of remorse or shame is a bit of a hallmark for psychopathy. And I'm going to interrupt myself right now to tell you a somewhat disturbing story that'll illustrate that. Because most of the stories with psychopaths involved are disturbing. So I evaluated a psychopath, and the psychopath's crime was, over 3 days, there was a crime spree. The psychopath, he was a Crip, and he went with one of his fellow Crips, welcome, to a 7-Eleven, and they robbed the 7-Eleven together with a firearm. During the course of that robbery, he noticed that two of the workers at the 7-Eleven were female, and he committed sexual batteries on both of the workers. After that, he retreated to an apartment complex nearby that he was familiar with, where he had already noticed that there was a woman that he planned to attack. So he went to her apartment right after committing the crime. He broke into her apartment. She was 8.5 months pregnant, and he held her hostage for 2 days, during which he beat her and raped her repeatedly, pausing in the middle in order to call his cohort, who had assisted in the robbery, and brag about what he was doing, which was actually somehow audio recorded and led to his conviction. So there's a fair amount of writing in the literature that describes psychopaths as predators, and they are predators. And in interviewing him, of course, like you all, I was horrified by the crime. In particular, the vulnerability of the victim, being 8.5 months pregnant. And so what was interesting to me and what I wanted to know about this crime was, why had he selected this victim? Had he selected the victim because she was so very vulnerable, because she was 8.5 months pregnant? Was that additionally exciting to him over selecting someone who wasn't so obviously to term with pregnancy? So I asked him why he picked her. And his response was, Come on, Murthy. Pregnant women need sex, too. What's wrong with you? And then he burst out laughing. And what that really brings up is, in this case, you see that there is no sense of regret or remorse about the behavior. It is entertaining to him, and there is no sense of shame about the behavior as well. And that is a characteristic of psychopaths when confronted upon their horrid acts, that there is no remorse and that there is no sense of shame. Okay, we'll allude more to that story later. Next criterion is inadequately motivated antisocial behavior. And what Cleckley's talking about is that people will sometimes engage in antisocial or criminal behavior for a variety of reasons. You know, one might be revenge or they're wronged. Take, for example, the man whose woman has just had an affair on him and she's leaving him. And so in a fit of rage, he commits a crime, insert crime there. So that's motivated antisocial behavior. For psychopaths, there need be no motivation for their antisocial behavior because it's part of who they are. It's their nature to commit crime, to break laws, and to harm people and violate the rights of others. And that's what Cleckley's talking about with inadequately motivated antisocial behavior. Because I can. Poor judgment and failure to learn from experience. And what he's talking about, and this is very true of psychopaths, is that their behavior continues. Even in the face of getting caught, even in the face of repeated punishments, they will continue to engage in criminal behavior without really much of a thought to the potential consequences. Pathologic egocentricity and incapacity for love. So they're generally very self-centered. They're focused on themselves and their own needs. They're focused on gratifying their drives, whether that be for power, money, sex. That's what their focus is. And other people exist as a means to gratify their drive. There is no capacity for love, and loving relationships are absent, although at times people are very fooled into believing that psychopaths love them. General poverty and major affective reactions. Cleckley observed that psychopaths don't seem to respond to the full spectrum of emotion that most people do, and that's very true. Generally, when you sit with a psychopath, you're going to feel a lot less emotion in the room, and there will be certain emotions that you really won't feel at all. You won't notice fear, and you won't notice caring or compassion or sadness. Specific loss of insight. Psychopaths are not insightful into themselves. They don't have insight into the way they affect other people, and they don't have insight into their own emotional world. They're very focused on gratifying their drives, on things that excite them, but they're very much unable to talk reasonably about their feelings or acknowledge their effect on other people. Unresponsiveness to general interpersonal relations. Their relationships are very superficial. As I said, people are a means to an end for them, towards gratifying some drive. There is not a sense of relatedness or connectedness with others. Fantastic and uninviting behavior with drink and sometimes without. So psychopaths are very prone to being bored. And what this is about is that their behavior is outrageous, frequently outrageous. They engage in high stimulation-seeking type of behavior that may be completely outrageous to the rest of us, that almost looks as if they're drunk or they're high because their behavior is so out of control. And when you add a controlled substance, which in 1943 was most likely alcohol, but today we can say meth or cocaine in addition to alcohol, their behavior becomes even more outrageous. Suicide rarely carried out, not a criterion anymore. But what he was commenting on is the fact that psychopaths' pathology is other-directed. Some people direct anger inwardly, and those people are vulnerable to depression and maybe suicidal thoughts and suicide. That psychopaths, as a rule, are generally more likely to direct their drive and aggression towards others, not so much towards themselves. We don't really follow this today, and when I'm talking to people in mental health treatment positions, especially in prisons, I'm very cautious about suicide rarely carried out. I want them to know that that's really not true anymore, because when you incarcerate a psychopath for life and that person has no hope of getting out, then things have a way of changing and they can become depressed and they can make suicide attempts. sex life, impersonal, trivial, and poorly integrated. So sex is something that psychopaths are certainly interested in. They're very much oriented towards gratifying their basic drives. But the capacity for human relatedness, for loving, caring relationships, is absent. So what ends up happening is quite a bit of sex, but without any integration into the life or integration of a relationship. Failure to follow any life plan. Because psychopaths are very oriented towards living in the moment and being exactly where they are and enjoying it as best they can, they generally don't have much of a life plan about any long-term plans. Now, there are certainly exceptions, and this is a criterion that does receive an exception. You know, we do encounter psychopaths who have managed to become chief psychiatrists or heads of surgery. Absolutely true. I'll talk more about that later. But the basic premise that you should be aware of is that psychopaths are very oriented towards being in the moment because they're all about gratifying their drives. And to gratify your basic drives, you're generally living in the moment. And they generally don't have a lot of plans. Okay, so that covers Cleckley. Cleckley also talked a little bit about the psychopath in the community, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later on, white-collar psychopaths and psychopaths who might be among us but are less easily identifiable. Robert Hare is the next great. Well, actually, Reed Malloy came between the two, and he wrote a great book called The Psychopathic Mind that I just love, but it focuses more on treatment issues that are relevant for mental health clinicians, so I decided I wouldn't really bring that up today. But after Malloy comes Robert Hare next in 1993, and he did some really important things. What he wanted to do was he wanted to quantify psychopathy, because up till this point there had been a discussion of what a psychopath was, but there wasn't a way to measure and really identify, well, who is a psychopath? So Hare decided he wanted to do that. So he created the psychopathy checklist, which is what we're using today to identify who is and who is not a psychopath. And what this is it's 20 criteria, similar to the ones we went over before, and I'll be going over them in a second. And the way we administer it is people who receive extensive training in the scoring and application of this instrument, and only those people can use it to identify psychopaths. They're given a rating of between 0 and 2 for each criterion, which would yield a maximum score of 40. The cutoff rate to identify a psychopath is 30, and this is the tool that we use to identify criminal psychopaths. One thing that you would note just from the math in that, 20 criteria, maximum points 40, 30 is a positive. You should have deduced that the truth is that not every person who's administered this test is going to elevate on every single criterion. So I'm glad you deduced that. And what happens as a result of that is that there is going to be some heterogeneity in the population itself. Not all psychopaths are going to look alike. And I'm going to be talking about this a little bit more in a moment. I'll just briefly say that the PCLR, Psychopathy Checklist Revised, is the tool that we use, but only people who are specifically trained and practiced in using it should even attempt to apply it. In the past, it's been used by people who haven't had the training, and it becomes very dangerous to do that. So these are Hare's criteria, which are what we're using today internationally. This is what the community uses. So the first criterion is glibness and superficial charm, and that's what I talked about before. It's about having a silver tongue and being very charming, and in many cases they are. Now, this is also one of those criteria that it's really not a core piece. The prototypical psychopath a la Ted Bundy is very glib, and superficially he was very charming. But not all of them are. Some of them are barely verbal and don't have this ability to suck you in and captivate you and make you feel like you're very important to them. But nonetheless, they can still be psychopathic. Grandiose sense of self-worth. Most psychopaths will have this, and this will be on display. And again, this is the narcissism, the grandiose ego. And what it's about is a need for them to appear powerful, to appear really special and unique in some way. And often they'll be bragging about themselves. I'm going to give you an example. Ted Bundy at one point was questioned by the police, and at one point he was confronted with a number of murders he had committed, and the police said to him, "So it appears that you've killed 36 women." And he said, "Well, if you add another digit to that, you might be a little bit closer." And what that is that's an illustration of his grandiosity, because he felt special and unique and powerful. And him pointing out that he may have killed over 100 women was a way of sort of bragging and shoring up his fragile sense of self. Need for stimulation. So psychopaths are very easily bored, and as a result, they tend to seek high stimulation behavior. They may ride motorcycles, they may drive really fast, they may use hard drugs, they may commit crimes for the rush, even risking getting caught because it's exciting to them. Pathological lying, we talked about, it's a way of being. They're known for telling, in particular, outrageous lies, and they're able to convince people on the force of their apparent belief in themselves, surprisingly. Often, when a psychopath is brought out in the media, and later on there's an examination of what it exactly it was that this person portrayed themselves and who they had fooled, it can be very surprising the degree to which they're able to do that, because when someone appears very confident and convinced, they can be very convincing to other people, even if the lie is quite outrageous. Conning and manipulative. So think of Ted Bundy there as well, with his duping of these women, preying on their vulnerability and their desire to help. And it's a characteristic of most psychopaths. Lack of remorse and guilt. This is one of the sine qua non, meaning it's that without which you wouldn't have psychopathy. If you have true remorse or true feelings of guilt in an individual, it's likely not a psychopath. They're not remorseful, and they don't really experience guilt. Shallow affect. This is a very interesting one. And this pertains to the fact that psychopaths don't have a very deep understanding of emotions. And I'll be talking a little bit more about that later. But one of the ways that you can really identify a psychopath, and you shouldn't jump to any conclusions, but when I'm doing my evaluations, I have them talk a lot about their feelings. And it's very difficult for psychopaths to talk about their feelings. Sometimes the questions I'll ask them are, well, how did you feel about that? That's almost the standard question, in particular as it relates to their crimes. And when I'm getting responses like, well, bad, and that's shallow affect. You know, you hear the word bad, but there's no emotion that accompanies it. Or I felt that she shouldn't have done that. Or I felt that she had it coming. There's a difficulty in talking about their feelings. And when their feelings are sort of discussed, there's not an emotional resonance that you can sense in the room. It's just words without any music. Lack of empathy is the other hallmark, that they are not aware of the feelings, needs, and rights of other people. They're not able to appreciate the harm they do because they're quite blind to that. And that is one of the core pieces of psychopathy, that anyone who is classified as a psychopath will not have empathy. Parasitic lifestyle. I'm going to tell you another horror story now. I wish that I could not tell you only horrible stories, but the truth is that this is why I don't like working with psychopaths anymore, because there are no nice stories. So a psychopath I evaluated told me a story. And he told me that he had rolled into a new town, just got off the Greyhound bus. He'd spent every penny he had on the bus ticket, and he didn't really have a plan when he showed up. No long-term plan, right? So he got off the bus, and he decided what he'd do is he'd go hang out in sort of a public place where there was a lot of traffic and a lot of people coming and going and just watch. So that's what he did. He watched. After a while, he saw a very tall, awkward-looking, gangly woman. And he was struck by the fact that she looked so awkward and out of place and uncomfortable, and that really made him feel that this is someone that he could take advantage of. So this man, who was 250 pounds, completely bald, really an unattractive fellow, but surprisingly, when he wanted to be, could be suddenly very charming with his sort of smile and his sort of dancing eyes. It's really true. In spite of, I knew everything this man had done, but I could notice how suddenly charming he could be. So he walked up to her and he charmed her. And he talked her into letting him go home with her. So he did. And then he talked her into letting him stay with her. So he did. For the next 6 months, he laid on her couch, watched television, hung out by the pool, drank her beer, and ate her food while she went to work every day. And he didn't do anything or contribute anything. And that's sort of, often you see that among psychopaths. He did that for 6 months, and then after that period of time, he located another victim who had a young child that he wanted to molest. So he then introduced himself to the next victim, and he moved in with the family, and he began grooming the child, and he sexually assaulted the child, including at one point at knife point. So parasitic lifestyle, you see, they're not inclined to work for themselves. They're not self-providers for the most part. They're inclined to use other people. Poor behavioral controls. So they tend to be generally impulsive. They don't really know right from wrong in the sense that we do. They don't connect to it. They know what they're doing is wrong, but they don't connect to it. And their behavior tends to be somewhat uncontrolled in the service of gratifying their needs. They'll do whatever they want to do to gratify their needs. Promiscuous sexual behavior, because there's no emotional attachment in their relationships, they don't have loving attachments, but they are very oriented towards their basic drives, and sex is one of them. They're likely to have sex with a lot of different partners, and there's not going to be any fidelity here. Early behavior problems, because we know that psychopathy is a personality disorder, and we know that it starts at a very young age. Behavior problems are often prevalent at a very young age. Ted Bundy's aunt later said that she had this very strange experience when Ted was 3 years old of waking up and after having taken a nap on the couch in the family room, and finding Ted standing over her with a series of knives arranged around her, and Ted was grinning. So early behavior problems are something that we expect with psychopaths, because it starts at a very young age. Lack of realistic long-term goals. Often they won't have long-term goals. Like I said, there may be some exceptions. Some of the more high-functioning and successful psychopaths may appear to have goals. But for the most part, most of the psychopaths I encounter really don't. And then if you ask them a question like, well, what are you going to do when you get out of prison? You know, what's the plan? You know, somebody with a seventh grade education can sit there who's 44 and say, you know, I've always thought that I'd be an astronaut, and be completely serious at that moment. And I've had that experience, and it's not a joke. They're actually saying that and thinking that I'll believe it. Because in many cases, what they're doing is they're living in the moment. They do tend to be more impulsive because they're motivated towards getting their drives met, whether those drives are for power, for money, for sex, or for anything that's going to make them feel more special, more unique, more powerful. Irresponsibility, so they're generally irresponsible. They're, you know, not going to take care of their children. They're not going to be breadwinners. They're not going to have any kind of responsible standards in their life. Failure to accept responsibility is a little bit different. That's when psychopaths are confronted with what it is that they've done, well, you realize that you really hurt that person. They don't take responsibility for their actions. They'll minimize it. Oh, you know, it wasn't that bad. I mean, a lot of children have sex. Or they'll deny it. I didn't do it. Or they'll find a way to blame the victim. That happens a lot, too. Many short-term marital relationships. So this is when they engage in marital relationships. And again, what this really brings up is the fact that their relatedness is really something that they don't engage in terms of loving, serious relationships with people. They're more oriented towards getting their needs met. So marital relationships may serve needs for them. They may get married so that they have money or someone to take care of their house or provide them with something. These relationships tend to be pretty brief because there's no real substance to them, although sometimes the partner believes there is, which tends to be sad. Juvenile delinquency. So the criminal behavior often starts very young for them. We see it as much as like 6, 7, 8 years old with criminal behavior being noted. So that's something we would expect because we're talking about crime as a way of life and behavior which is entrenched and starts very young. Revocation of conditional release. This is a quantified way of kind of looking at how psychopaths do on parole or probation. They don't do well on parole or probation because generally they're not good at following rules, and because criminal behavior, which violates parole and probation, is something that's very much their way of being in the world. And then criminal versatility. I say that for psychopaths, crime is a way of life. You know, one of the reasons I didn't want to just talk about serial killers is I didn't want to give you the idea that psychopaths are just serial killers. They're not. They're people for whom violating the rights of others comes very natural. So committing crimes and committing a variety of crimes and a variety of different crimes is something that we expect from psychopaths and something that we look for. When scoring criminal versatility, what I'm looking for is, well, they may have committed crimes against a person, such as assault with a deadly weapon, attempted murder, but they've also committed crimes against property like vandalism, theft. They may have committed forgery. They may have sold drugs. I'm looking for sort of a constellation of criminal behaviors, not just one specific category. Okay, so that was a mouthful. So Hare took all of these criteria, and he looked at two core factors that he thought were present for the psychopath. And these we've talked about already, so they should be somewhat self-apparent. One, that they have this narcissistic character. They have this need to be the grandiose self and this lack of emotional connection to others. That's the narcissism. Examples are grandiose, lack of empathy, shallow affect. And then they also engage in this lifelong pattern of antisocial criminal behavior. And that's irresponsible, parasitic lifestyle, conning, manipulative, parole violations. So these are the two factors that the psychopathy checklist splits the criteria into. Hare did some exploration of where do psychopaths come from, and it's an interesting piece, a very interesting piece. And his contention is that psychopaths are born, not made. And there's a fair amount of research looking at twin studies that suggests that there is a strong heritability component for psychopathy. So we know that there's a strong genetic component. Like most things, we believe that it's a matter of genes and environment interacting to yield personality. That's generally our take on it. But that it's not a failure of the maternal holding environment, as was thought in the 70s. That there is a heritability and a biological component to it. So he looked at family histories because he was curious about that. And he took a look at psychopaths versus non-psychopathic criminals. And he wanted to know, are their families specifically different? Could some family differences be attributable for the psychopathy? And he found that there were really no differences between the non-psychopathic criminals' families and the psychopathic criminals' families. Interestingly, he found that non-psychopathic criminals who came from good homes, homes that were intact, nurturing, loving, tended to start their criminal behavior later on than non-psychopathic criminals who came from more disturbed or unstable homes. Whereas for psychopaths, it didn't make a difference if the home environment was nurturing or was not. The criminal behavior started early in either case. How it was different was psychopaths who came from homes that were found to be unstable were quicker to display more violent behavior in their criminal behavior. But the criminal behavior started at around the same time. One of the biggest pieces relates to recidivism, and that becomes really important to me because I'm in a position of making decisions about who should stay in prison and who can be considered for a safe release into the community. And recidivism becomes extremely important for that reason. He found that psychopaths are two times as likely as non-psychopathic criminals to reoffend within a set period of time. It was 3 to 5 years in that research. And three times more likely than non-psychopathic criminals to commit a violent crime. So that's extremely useful to me because that tells me that when I've identified someone as a psychopath, right away their risk for violent crime has just tripled, and I need to be very, very careful in thinking about releasing this person into the community. Hare's research also noticed that while psychopaths made up only about 1/5 or 20% of the prison population, they actually were responsible for as much as 50% of the more serious crime perpetrated by the prison population. So they're responsible for more severe crimes. He explored psychopathic violence as instrumental versus passionate. In many points, criminals commit crimes for emotional reasons, like they've been rejected or abandoned, but not psychopaths. Psychopaths commit crime as a means to an end. They're very capable of committing what appear to be passionate crimes in the service of revenge, frequently. But for the most part, a characteristic of the violence of psychopaths is that it's a means to an end. An interesting statistic, 2/3 of non-psychopaths' victims were female family members, friends, or acquaintances. But for psychopaths, 2/3 of the victims were male strangers. And what that talks about is that for non-psychopaths, there was probably some level of connection between them and the victim. But for psychopaths, there was no connection. It was whoever they encountered, which was most likely about 2/3 male. So the research is very conclusive on the issue of treatment. Psychopaths do not appear to benefit from treatment. There is some research that suggests that psychopaths who receive treatment are actually quicker to commit violent crimes than psychopaths who did not receive treatment. That's been replicated a couple of times, but it's an original study from 1989. But we can conclude that psychopaths do not improve. And we're talking specifically about recidivism and violent crime here. I'm going to talk a little bit more about other types of treatment in a second. So psychopaths aren't motivated for treatment. When someone enters into therapy, it's because they've identified that there's something wrong, something's not working, and they want to take a look at themselves, and they're thinking that, well, they might want to change some things. And psychopaths don't think that. They don't think there's anything wrong with them. They're extremely comfortable being who they are. They don't think anything's wrong with it. Quite the opposite. They think that they're fantastic. That's the grandiosity, right? So they're not inclined to be motivated for therapy. They're not inclined to change at all. When they enter into therapeutic situations, it's most likely that there's an ulterior motivation. And that ulterior motivation is often that they want to get sent to a psychiatric hospital because they're looking at a murder trial and they don't want life in prison. They'd rather be found not guilty by reason of insanity and go to a psychiatric hospital. I evaluated a case like that. Or they're interested in psychiatric medications that they can either use to get intoxicated on or else they can sell. Or they want to be in a psychiatric milieu where they can be the most dominant, most intelligent, most capable individuals and can prey on the mentally ill. So the motivations for therapy are not there for them. Behavior is entrenched, it's lifelong, and it's a personality, it's who they are, and it's not likely to change. And they often go through the mechanics in therapy. They'll try to learn what it is they're supposed to say, and then they'll try to say that to the therapist and use that in the service of getting some type of privilege or seeing what they can get out of the situation. And we have to be very careful with them because psychopaths in particular will really try to learn about mental illness in order to manipulate the system. So we have to be very careful what we teach them, and that's why identifying them is really important. Now, psychopaths are vulnerable to depression and psychosis. They're vulnerable to depression because when you suddenly receive a life sentence in prison because you've committed horrendous acts or you've struck out on 3 strikes, and you know you're never getting out, and you may be housed in administrative segregation where you are having very little contact with other people, you're not allowed to go out to a yard, you're cramped into a tiny cell, and you know that that's not going to change. Even psychopaths can get depressed. It may manifest with more irritability, hostility, anger, acting out behavior, but even psychopaths can get depressed, and even psychopaths can make suicide attempts, and they can succeed as well. So we do, at times, treat them in that respect, not because we think we're going to change them into people who are not dangerous, but because we don't want them to kill themselves, and we want to treat their depression, because that's our mission. Psychopaths are also vulnerable to psychosis. It's very possible that an individual could be psychopathic and schizophrenic. That's an interesting situation when it happens, and it makes for some really clinically interesting material. But at times, in either of these cases, with a psychosis, somebody who's hearing voices or delusional or unable to perceive reality, or, and someone who's depressed, when we treat those situations, the depression or the psychosis, with medications, we might treat those and restore them to their baseline or to a healthier baseline, they can become more dangerous, and that's something that we're mindful of, because then they're an unfettered psychopath, as opposed to someone who's unable to read reality or someone who's more depressed and not going to be looking to take advantage and harm others. What are we doing for time? Oh, okay. So briefly, I'll talk about white and blue-collar psychopaths. So the general prevalence of psychopathy in society is about 1%. Studies vary, 0.2 to 2%, about 1%. They're often drawn to positions of power. So you may want to be aware of that if you're thinking that you may have encountered one. But what you're looking for is a long-standing pattern of severe morally inappropriate behavior, ethics violations, psychiatrists who have repeatedly had sex with their patients, people who have been successfully sued, medical practitioners who really didn't pass competency boards and lied about their experience or competence. Deception, unnecessary and outrageous lying, we see that. Remember, lying is really characteristic, and deception as well. So they're going to be telling a lot of lies and frequently really outrageous lies, especially about some of their past, their accomplishments, their certifications. And then unnecessary destructiveness. These are extremely destructive people. If you're thinking about someone you know that might be a psychopath, the odds are that what you need to figure out is this person psychopathic or just narcissistic? So if they're just narcissistic, they're grandiose, and they're insensitive, and they're self-centered, and everyone around them is really annoyed with them and really tired of them talking about themselves, and they don't really care about anybody but them. If they're psychopathic, they're actively harming everybody around them. Everybody around them is really suffering, and there will be sort of a trail of broken bodies, whether they be broken hearts or physically broken bodies or ruined careers. That's kind of what you're looking for. And then the superficial and promiscuous relationships, just as we've talked about. They may be very charming, but that deeper connectedness is not there. Okay, this is a very abridged piece on neuropsychology, and I'm just going to run through it in a minute. Psychopaths show a general level, lower level of general arousal as measured by electrodermal response. And a lower fluctuation as well. The research is pretty interesting in that respect. It appears that they're sort of generally hypo-aroused, which might explain their need for excitement and proneness to boredom. But in various situations which cause people to become much more aroused, like, for example, a research experiment that Hare did where they were asked to administer electric shocks to other people, psychopaths' level of arousal really didn't change much when they were required to perform that task, as opposed to non-psychopaths who naturally became very freaked out when they were told they should shock someone. Insensitivity to sadness and fearfulness, in a variety of ways, they have difficulty identifying visually pictures of sad or fearful people and describing what those are. They have difficulty identifying in terms of hearing sad or fearful voices. They have a hard time identifying those things. And it appears that they themselves exhibit lower levels of sadness and fear. As well, a lack of a startle response. They're not easily startled or jarred. And the prototypical experiment was they were showed a series of slides, including some very aversive ones that contained scenes murder scenes and crime scenes, really disturbing stuff. And their eyes were measured to see if they blinked or exhibited a startle response. And for them, they didn't. And they didn't experience a significant arousal in seeing those slides as opposed to the neutral ones as well. And then diminished avoidance learning. And this becomes kind of relevant for us as well. And what this is, avoidance learning occurs when we can anticipate that something negative is going to happen to us, or we're not going to get something positive. So we stop doing a certain behavior that we know is going to lead to a negative consequence. Psychopaths don't really do that. On research that examines their response during situations when they should have learned, like they receive a negative consequence from a certain behavior, they will persist with the same behavior over time. So they show really a decreased learning in this area. There's been some volumetric and fMRI research. I'm just going to go through it really briefly and superficially. But Tionin found that amygdala volume for psychopaths was actually lowered as opposed to control. So it looks like there's some possible defect in their amygdala, which is a small almond-shaped subcortical structure that lies beneath the cortex and that is usually associated with emotions. And the fMRI study as well by Kyle noted that on emotional memory tasks, their amygdala of a psychopath actually was activated less than that of the non-psychopaths. So there's some discussion that it may be an interaction that includes the amygdala and certain aspects of the prefrontal cortex that may relate to or help us to understand some of the emotional pieces and the behavior that we see in psychopaths. Okay, time for questions. Please.
Could you tell me the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath?
Okay, sure. So those terms have been used kind of interchangeably throughout history. Sociopath actually goes back to right around the 1960s, 1970s, early 60s, really, where it came up. And the idea then was back then there was sort of a focus on the idea that it was all mental illness and personality were attributable completely to nurture, to the environment. So that's where the term sociopath came from, that there was something about the environment that caused someone to be pathological or sick. Now when we use the term sociopath, clinically we don't use it. It's not a term for us. But when it's used, probably more likely by sociologists than psychologists, they're really describing someone who might be more of an antisocial person. So antisocial personality disorder is it's a personality type where a person has no respect for the laws, engages in thrill-seeking behavior, has restricted capacity for empathy, and may be more aggressive. That's antisocial personality disorder. Psychopaths are a subset of antisocial personality disorder. They're like an antisocial personality disorder squared, a much more severe version where there is no remorse and there is no empathy and there is this aggressive destructiveness. So they're like a more severe subset. Okay. Please. No, you really don't. You want to be really, really careful with making any decisions about children. I'm going to say that there is this thing called the Psychopathy Checklist Youth Version. I don't use it. I'll probably never use it because you don't want to give a child that label. The label conduct disorder is bad enough. Now, I don't want to take away from the reality of it. The reality of it is that there are children that probably are psychopaths, and at some point when a family is dealing with that, it's honestly helpful for them to know what they're really dealing with. You want to be really, really careful about affixing that label, and I am not inclined to affix the label psychopath to a child because of where they are developmentally. I'm inclined to lean towards thinking about conduct disorder and then taking a very specific behavioral approach. That's the approach to take in managing their behavior and teaching them what behavior is accessible and what is not. And the way to do that is with very, very thorough controls. Public school is probably a bad idea. You want them in an environment where you have a high level of supervision and control over their behavior, at least to really be sure that you're seeing and dealing with the full scope of their behavior. You want very clear consequences for all of their behaviors in order to manage their behavior and to teach them to manage it. Is there another question?
I can imagine that this is a very, very difficult thing for you, assuming you're not a psychopath, because of empathy and so forth. And so how do you deal with that, and how can you also be completely objective with the variety of people you encounter as a result?
Mm-hmm. Working with psychopaths is really challenging. One of the important things that we do is we try to get more education, and that's really key. Clinicians have a variety of responses to working with psychopaths. There is the response of therapeutic nihilism, which is, I'm going to give up. There's nothing I can do for this person. I'm therefore just going to quit. which isn't really what you want to do. You still want to be looking at the behavior and doing your best to see what you can do about improving controls, and don't be jaded about who it is that you're working with, but nonetheless, you don't want to quit. They may even have a depression or be suicidal. Another is the illusory treatment alliance, which occurs when the clinician doesn't want to accept that the person they're working with is a psychopath, doesn't want to accept. Many clinicians refuse to accept that psychopathy exists because they struggle with that. How can you work empathically if you feel that there is nothing to be done for this person? So in some cases, this illusory treatment alliance that Reed Malloy talks about is sort of a fantasy on the part of the clinician that they're actually helping the person, which in some cases a psychopath can then sort of work with. Me, I don't really like to work with them very much. It doesn't give much back to me. I like to work with people who are capable of caring. One of the things that I can say is that every now and then I find one who's charming and entertaining, and in that case, I guess I can sort of enjoy that. But, I'm generally seeking to always be objective in my work, and I think I do a pretty good job. They don't really trigger the destroy response, which is another one, the desire to destroy them, which sometimes happens with clinicians because it's such an affront who these people are and what they've done. Sometimes. Sometimes it does. Sometimes they're sentenced provisionally with an evaluation to determine whether or not they should receive an additional sentence or what the best outcome would be. They may be up for a board of prison terms. They may be a lifer, and the question is, are they rehabilitated? So sometimes those questions are relevant. Back there. You, please. Haven't read it, sorry.
You talked about sort of grandiose self-perception and so on, and the lying. Do sociopaths or psychopaths, do they believe the lies?
See, that's a really interesting question. And the answer is, I think so. Because it's really hard to sort out, because you're kind of caught in this web of lies and denial. That's where the deception and the denial sort of work together. Certainly they know they're lying to you when they're lying. But because there's this level of denial about their behavior and the consequences on others and some of their more base emotions that can't be owned, like jealousy, both are operating. So it's kind of a bit of a minefield figuring out exactly what they're knowingly lying about and what they're not. Some things are more obvious. I didn't shoot that person is obviously a lie. And then others, it's a little bit more tricky. Yep.
Are there particular types of people who would be prone to get caught up with psychopathy?
People who have more of a dependent side are more prone to get caught up with psychopaths. People who are very emotionally needy and who are capable of sort of deluding themselves that being in this extremely unhealthy relationship is a good idea. Like the classic is sort of like, think of the sort of prototypical battered woman syndrome. Someone who sort of has very low self-esteem, so they feel important. The psychopath can make them feel important, and they believe the psychopath's grandiose projections about themselves. They really believe this guy is really intelligent and really accomplished and really powerful, and they're just so happy that he's taking an interest in them. So that's usually what it is. We see the marital relationship piece is an interesting one. So many short-term marital relationships until they get the life sentence. And then they get married, and they hold on to that marriage for as long as they can. Please.
Mm-hmm. And has been shown to have antisocial personality traits on the MBI, which tend to resolve the treatment. The treatment is not the usual psychiatric drug treatment.
Well, I'm not aware of any co-occurrence between psychopathy and any specific sleep disorders. I don't believe that there's any literature that establishes that there's any connection there.
There's no research on the evidence.
Not to my knowledge. You might be the first. Okay, please. Okay.
Yet most of these criteria seem to be pretty closely connected to criminal activities.
Yes.
How does this work for non-criminals?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. Thank you very much. So it's a bit of a trick. The PCLR was developed and standardized on incarcerated populations, and it's the tool that we really use to look at incarcerated or criminal populations. In that respect, it's most useful. It's more difficult to establish a psychopath, but you want to look for some of these criteria that I was discussing earlier. You want to look for more, the lack of empathy, the lack of remorse, the extensive history of ethical violations or moral transgressive behavior, the severe harm to other people, the lies, and then, the grandiose character. That's what you want to look for. But it is more difficult to identify someone who may be a psychopath in the community who hasn't committed a crime yet. One thing I would point you to is there's a really interesting article in the New Yorker. I don't know if you guys have read it at all. It's about a psychiatrist from New Zealand named Colin Bauer. So it sounds like you're familiar with that. And that's a really good description. And, until he got caught with murdering his wife, he didn't have a criminal history, at least not one that any of us are aware of. It may have been expunged from his juvenile records. But it's more difficult, really, to identify a psychopath when they don't have the criminal background. Then the trick is this somebody who's a narcissist and just intolerable, or somebody who's a psychopath and who's really dangerous? Okay, O'Reilly? Well, that's a good question. I would say it's difficult to know because, let's take Madoff. I don't know enough about his childhood. If I were to learn that he had a long-standing pattern of, sexual abuse of his adopted younger sister as a child and a variety of sort of really inappropriate behaviors before he developed the Ponzi scheme, then I'd start thinking more psychopath. As it is right now, I'm thinking narcissist, certainly narcissist. There was one over there somewhere. Okay, well, yours. Yes, they're more male. Yeah, research suggests, and could have gone into gender and culture. Research suggests the prevalence of psychopaths among men is significantly higher than that of women. In fact, there's been some discussion that psychopathy may manifest somewhat differently among women, and there's been a supposition that what might need to happen is that the psychopathy checklist, which is used for women, the cutoff score should be lowered when assessing women down to 26. One more.
Or maybe two.
All right, let me get these two. Go ahead.
Have you ever heard of psychopathy change?
No. But sometimes there's what's called a behavioral dip in the 40s. That's the best you can hope for. Many personality disorders in the 40s suddenly kind of decrease some of their more outrageous behavior. You see it with borderlines, and you see it with psychopaths, too. They don't change who they are. They just get a little bit burnt out, and they stop acting out as much. Okay. In all likelihood, all serial killers are psychopaths. Remorse and empathy are something that serial killers don't have. The only possible exception I can think of would be someone who, because of their severe psychosis, is a serial killer. If somebody killed specifically because they had delusional beliefs that they had to kill seven people in order to stop the Armageddon and acted on it, and we do have such people, they could technically be considered potentially a serial killer, but possibly not a psychopath because they're doing it in the service of their insanity. But they also might be a psychopath with a major mental illness, too.
Okay, well, I want to thank you, Dr. Burke.
Thank you.